Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Chapman Schwartz was in the driver's seat of his Jeep, heading from the control tower and towards the crash site. Along the way, his heart was racing so fast, he thought he might have a heart attack. In all of his time in the Army Air Corps as a chaplain, he thought that he had seen and experienced it all. But this was on a whole new level of horrible, awful, sickening, and gut-wrenching. Looking ahead, Chaplain Schwartz saw men exiting the wounded fortress. All of them looked like zombies instead of people. As Chaplain Schwartz pulled up to the bomber and put his Jeep in park, he got out, planted both feet on the ground, and the moment he looked into the faces of the men exiting Lord Abul, his eyes welled up with tears, and he wondered how any of these men would ever recover from something like this. Six days earlier, May 4th, 1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0933. Tommy was just waking up after a long night of drinking at the enlisted men's club. Looking around the hut, Tommy saw that the only person left inside the hut was Willie, who was still passed out. Wondering where everyone else went, Tommy got out of his bed, stretched, and walked over to Willie. Tapping him on the chest, Willie woke up startled and yelled,
"I'm gonna get you, fucking Dolph!"
"Dolph? Who the hell is Dolph?" Tommy asked. Sitting up, Willie began rubbing sleep out of his eyes. After that, Willie looked up at Tommy and said,
"He's the fucking kraut that taunched me, the fucker he is.
What's so goddamn important that you had to wake me up? Do you know where everyone's at?" "Tommy, do I look like I would know where everyone's at? I was literally nuts deep in sleep, and you woke me up to ask me if I know where everyone's at."
"Sorry, Willie. Look, I didn't know if you heard them leave or possibly heard where they were going this morning."
"Well, I didn't," Willie said, before he swung his feet out of his bed and onto the floor. Tommy walked back to his bed and sat on the edge of it and replied,
Did you black out last night?"
"I mean, it's either that or I passed out at the club and you guys dragged me back here because, well, let's see. The last thing I remember was asking the bartender what bra size his wife was, and Mills was holding him back because he got all upset. What a fucking asshole he was."
"See, I don't even remember that. The last thing I remember was going outside to piss with Marshy."
"You know, I gotta be honest with you. I like that kid, Marshy. California, on the other hand, still not sure about him."
"Yeah, I like Marshy too. Muth seems like he's got a stick up his ass.
You know, I'm going to show you right. Jesus, my fucking stomach's hurting now. Well, I say we get dressed and then we head over to the mess hall. Judging by the time, they got to be serving lunch here pretty soon, Tommy suggested. It sounds like a plan to me, bud. I need some sustenance. As the two men started getting dressed, Tommy then looked over at Willie and said, When's your mess duty? Tomorrow. Oh, okay. Well, hey, I was wondering if you could, somehow in your way, your Willy way, get to the point. Okay. I was wondering if you could get us off base just for tonight. I told you, I'm scheduled to do mess duty tomorrow, meaning none of us are cleared to leave the base yet. Look, I know that. That's why I'm coming to you, the mighty Jew himself. Hey. That's sure, Mr. Jew to you. Okay, well, whatever, Willie. Point is, I have faith that you can smuggle us out of here tonight. Tommy, what is so goddamn important that you want to risk getting skinned by the Bosch Michelle for going AWOL? I've got to get to Burden Hand. What the hell is down there that's so goddamn important besides the Holy Spirit? And I'm not talking about the Christian one. I was talking with Mason Pointers, okay? I was talking to him last night. And he said that there's a bunch of girls that were down there a couple days ago and one of them was looking for me. Tommy, do you really believe that Mason's the same guy who told you that if you put gasoline around your bunghole and you farted that you could shit out fireballs? Yeah, he did tell me that. But listen, I'm telling you, he told me that one of the girls there was there about a week or so ago, and me and her got to talking or something, or we passed by each other. I don't know. But anyways, I was kind of in my almost blacking out phase when he told me this. But she came back to see if I was there the next night, and I wasn't. I can't let an opportunity like this slide. Tommy, this sounds like it's a scam that Mason's putting on just to get you to go drinking with him. I mean, I can see his point. Have you seen the rest of the fuckheads and his crew? Fucking Mormons drink more than they do. Willie, please. No, Tommy, I won't risk my head or my skin for some tale that you probably won't get. She'll have friends with her. All right, you talked me into it. I'll see what I can do. That's the spirit, Tommy said, patting his friend on the back as he made his way over to the door. Willie, with a smile appearing on his face, looked up and said, there better be a girl there tonight, Tommy, for all the fucking skin I'm risking. Well, you are a Jew, right? Tommy asked. Yeah? What'd you mean to you? Willie questioned, standing up and beginning heading towards the door. Well, your kind is kind of used to losing skin for faith. I'm asking you to lose some skin for me. Oh, you and the fucking Polish honker you got on you, you fucking Gentile, you. As the door opened, Willie looked up and saw that while it had rained all night long and into the morning, the sky was now clear and the world looked so green and alive. It's not even that big of a nose. Now, Rod, that fuck's got a beak if I've ever seen one, Tommy commented. Who? Willie asked as he led his way to the mess hall. Rod, you know that kid from the mission yesterday? The fuckhead who you threw out of the goddamn plane? Oh, wait. Was that his name? Willie asked. Who cares at this point? I know it was some R name. Something like that, like Rod. Yeah, it was like Rod or Robbie or Rich. Wasn't it. Make a good point. Doesn't fucking matter now. But, no, I was thinking last night. Do you think he made it to the ground? Well, I mean, no matter what, they'd make it to the ground, Tommy joked, walking along with Willie. It's true. I mean, do you think he made it to the ground alive? Well, I keep hearing these rumors about Germans blowing holes in airmen's chutes, and if they don't, they pitchfork you to death. The thing is, if I ever bail out, the only thing they're going to get to blow is Mike Johnson. You're circumcised, Johnson, Tommy corrected. Yes, the old little Abraham himself. It would be poetic justice for a Nazi bastard to have to shuck off an American Jew, don't you think? Willie kidded. It would be.
Maybe if we ever find ourselves shot down over Germany, we end up in some German girl's hayloft, we can act out some of that poetic justice. Oh, wouldn't that be the story of the century to tell your kids later down the road? Mother, how did you and father meet? Well, there, Lenny von Hinkle, whatever the fuck their names are going to be. Your dad bombed the fuck out of Berlin, and he got his ass blown out of the sky and ended up in my barn. And then he gave me the old Chicago Grand Slam. Yeah, that's the kind of stories they write books about, you know. Tommy furthered. Listen, if that would be the case, I would tell that story, get someone to write the book for me. I'm going to be a millionaire one day, Tommy. You'll see. Get myself a book deal and everything. If only I had knew someone that could write books for me and, Willie paused, not wanting to say another word, for he had said one too many words already. Judging by the look on Tommy's face, Tommy was feeling the same thing as Willie. Thoughts and images of Al and Skimpy flooded their minds. They both missed their old crewmates dearly and wanted them back. They were good kids, and they didn't deserve to have been killed in the way and time that they were. Tommy's mind began thinking about the lost talent, the potential books that would never be read or written because men like Skimpy and Al died before they ever had a chance or opportunity to make their mark or use their knowledge. How was it fair that those smart, talented, and overall amazing human beings got their flame snuffed out, yet he and Willie would get to live out their lives? They simply would never live up to the potential of someone like Al or Skimpy. It just wasn't fair.
Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them. They're sponsoring us, so I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where three hosts, a theater director, a movie critic, and a veteran come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable, and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close, check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Canso 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast.
The boss was arriving back at his hut. He had sustained a concussion from his fall 2 days previous. The boss had spent the previous day sitting at the hospital under evaluation, since the boss was experiencing symptoms such as vomiting and blurry vision, which ended up being as a result of the headache that he had. As the boss was getting settled in, that's when someone began knocking on the boss's door.
Come in.
As the door opened, the boss saw that it was Colonel Poole, and his heart began to race.
Captain Backus, Colonel Poole said.
Just so you know, Colonel, you came to me. I'm not in your office this time, the boss joked.
Wise guy.
Captain, I was just coming to check up on you since I wasn't able to see you yesterday. Doctor said that you were cleared to return to administrative duty, but you won't be cleared to fly until next week. Is that right?
That's right, the boss responded.
So how are you feeling now?
Well, I feel ready to fight, sir, if that's what you mean. Fighting isn't your job anymore, Captain Bacchus. Remember? That's the job of the men in your squadron. Your job is to lead them and keep them in a fighting spirit. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
The boss sheepishly replied. Colonel Poole stood and stared at the boss for some time until he finally spoke up, saying, Captain, are you all right? The boss's hair stood up on the back of his neck. He had tried so hard not to draw negative attention to himself. Could Andy have relayed his big secret to anyone before he was killed? He thought to himself. Captain, I need to know if you are okay to lead. I chose you because your peers thought you had what it took to be the leader of the 530th Squadron. But in the last week, now that I think about it, a week ago today, ever since that Brunswick mission, you seem to have lost everything you once had with your peers. The other squadron commanders don't talk highly of you anymore. I've even asked the orderlies around the headquarters about what it's like to be around you. And, they often say that they see you sitting in your office just staring at the wall in a daze. In fact, I spoke with the Sergeant Pillier earlier today, and he said that a couple days ago, he walked past your office and saw you cleaning up a broken glass that you had thrown against the wall. Yeah, you thought we didn't know about that, but you left a pretty nice mark on the wall. So, all that to be said, I'm asking you this man to man. Are you all right, Captain Bacchus? The boss took in a deep breath and then faced Colonel Poole. With as much fake gusto as he had left in him, he replied, I'm fine, sir. Honestly, I've just had a tough time adjusting. By the looks of it, Colonel Poole looked a bit skeptical of the boss's answer, but gave himself the benefit of the doubt. He nodded his head and then turned to leave, replying, Good. Well, the best thing I can tell you is, stiffen that upper lip, stand straight up, keep focus on your men and your job. Yes, sir. The boss replied, watching Colonel Poole walk out the door of the hut. Later that night, Tommy and Willie were waiting by the Jeep depots, waiting for Willie's contact to arrive and smuggle them out of the base.
Now, who's this guy again?
Tommy asked. He's my contact. Don't worry about it, Willie replied. I would just like to know who the hell I'm putting my life into the hands of. Me. You're putting your precious little life in my hands. Now stop bitching and just be patient. After a few more moments of banter, the officers arrived. Look, there he is. Okay, act natural, Willie softly commanded to Tommy. That's when Jack, Parnell, and Tango arrived at the Jeep depot and met the two men. Lieutenant Miller? A very confused Tommy called out. Tommy? Willie? Jack replied. You asked Jack? Tommy whispered to Willie. Yes, I did. I trust this man, commented Willie. Don't worry, Tommy. I won't rely any of this to the boss. I know just how to get you guys out, but there's one condition, though, Jack said. What's that? Tommy asked. Willie, who already knew what Jack was going to say, squinted his eyes and was waiting for the bad news to break to Tommy. You have to buy me and my two friends here a round of drinks for our troubles. Tommy looked over at Willie, who said, What? It was the only way I can get him to do it. Looking back at Jack, Tommy smiled and said, Okay, deal. How are we getting out? Let us worry about that, okay? Get in, please. Jack said, pointing to a Jeep that was behind them. What? Asked Tommy. You and Willie get in the back of the Jeep, and wait here. I'll be out in just a moment with the keys. But what if the boss walks by us and sees us? Tommy asked. The boss isn't going to be walking anywhere near here this time of night. Besides, you'll have two bodyguards, Jack said, walking around to the front office entrance and entering into it. In the meantime, both Willie and Tommy got in the back of the Jeep with no top to it, and once they were seated inside, Parnell asked the men, So, what's this What's this place we're going to? This pub called Bird in Hand? It's just down the road from here. It's not far at all. Tommy replied.
Is this a nice pub? Like the kind that has top shelf liquor?
Tango asked.
Sure, I guess. What do you think, Willie?
Oh yeah, they've got all kinds of nice stuff there, fellas. Trust me, this place is nice. Anything you want, they'll have. Why do you ask?
Oh, we were just thinking about what we were going to choose for our drinks. You know, because I've never tried 12-year-old scotch before. What about you, Tango?
Parnell asked.
Nope. Usually can't afford it. And when I can, I just can't justify spending that kind of cash on a drink. But, you know, with tonight, tonight's different.
Tango replied.
Couldn't agree more. I'm with you, Tango, said Parnell.
I'm with you guys too, Willie added. Tommy shot a look over at his friend, and that's when Willie shrugged his shoulders and retorted with,
What? We can't risk Jack telling the boss.
This is your fault, you know that?
Oh, quit being such a Mary. We're gonna have so much fun tonight, you'll be thanking me at the end of this evening. You watch.
Willie fired back, much to both Parnell and Tango's amusement. Soon, Jack returned with the keys to his Jeep, throwing them over to Parnell. That's when Jack got in the passenger seat, while Parnell jumped in the driver's seat. Tango jumped in the back with Willie and Tommy and took a seat on the wheel well behind Jack. Once the five men arrived at the hut along the exit road of the airfield, Parnell slowed down and Jack produced a piece of paper from his pocket and handed it to the MP. The MP grabbed the white piece of paper and opened it. Looking inside, he saw the words, Look the other way, Charlie, and the pack of smokes will be yours. The MP looked up at Jack holding a pack of Lucky Strike cigarettes in his hand. With a grin on his face, he took the pack of smokes and then waved the four men along, allowing them to leave.
That was amazing, Tommy called out.
It was. Now keep your fucking voice down and show me how to get to this place, Parnell called out. Little did Tommy and Willie know, the MP lost a friend on the Brunswick mission, and therefore had no problem going against the boss's orders. When Willie asked Jack for help, Jack knew that Charlie was the best person for the job. Tommy led Parnell right to Bird in Hand, and when they arrived, Parnell parked the Jeep in the front and switched the Jeep off.
What are you doing? Tommy asked. You guys are buying us drinks, right?
Tango asked.
We are, but I thought I was just going to give you cash.
No! Why would we go through all that week when you could just have a drink here, you know, under your tab?
Parnell said, pushing Tommy forward towards the front door. Soon, the five men entered through the front door of Bird in Hand and found themselves a seat at the table in the middle of the pub. Looking around, Tommy didn't see the group of women anywhere around them.
Jesus, where are they at? Willie whispered over to Tommy.
I don't know. They'll be here.
It's still early, Tommy said, looking down on his watch and seeing that it was only 7:26.
Hey, Tommy, you coming with me? I'll help you carry the drinks,
Jack said, looking over to Tommy.
Yep,
Tommy yelped as he quickly stood back up and made his way over to the bar with Jack. Once up there, Tommy ordered he and Willie 2 glasses of spiced rum, while Jack ordered 3 glasses of Irish red ale. As the bartender filled the drink order, that's when Jack looked over at Tommy and asked,
So, what's the deal? Why did you have to break the rule and come here? I mean, if it was for rum, I could have gotten you a bottle of rum easy.
It's a long story, Tommy replied.
All right, perfect. I've got all night.
Tommy paused, took a deep breath, and answered.
It's about a girl.
There it is.
Isn't always about a girl?
Jack reacted.
Yep. Well, listen, I hope it's worth it. My guess is she isn't here yet.
Not yet, but she will be.
I can drink to that,
Jack said as the bartender arrived back with the drinks. As Tommy reached into his pocket to grab the money, Jack slapped down a British pound note and slid it to the bartender. Looking shocked, Tommy responded,
But I thought...
Jack grabbed the 3 glasses and responded with, I couldn't take for one on my own. Before he went back towards the table, asking the men to thank Tommy for their liquid refreshment.
Tommy chuckled to himself, but went along with the ruse as he returned to the table, waiting for the supposed woman of his dreams to come walking into the pub. Back in Thurlow, Beans was sitting in the enlisted men's club, drinking his fifth pint of beer along with Muth. Mills, Marshy, and Marshy's friends were all on the other side of the club, drinking and goofing off. So far, Beans had come to like Muth a lot. For most of the day, since Marshy was on potato duty, Beans got to have more face time with one of his new crew members. To Beans, Muth looked and acted more like an officer than one of the crusty enlisted men. He always kept a serious, stoic appearance and gave off the impression that he was a hard ass. Beans, on the other hand, was a stark contrast to Muth in just about every way. Beans was from Wisconsin. Muth was from California. Beans was thin and had sort of a idiosyncratic nature to him that made him stand out amongst the others. On the other hand, Muth was built like a fighter and had the temperament of a bull, the same temperament that most of the gunners of the 300th had. Another thing that set the two men apart was their taste in alcohol. Beans was a beer kind of guy, while Muth was a hard liquor kind of guy and hated the taste of beer. The one redeeming quality of Muth that Beans found appealing, as well as the other guys in the 530th Squadron found appealing, was that Muth was loyal to those he cared about. Even though he disliked Marshy, Beans knew that in an instance, Muth would crush anyone who even attempted to threaten or hurt Marshy. That kindness spirit was the thing that men like Beans wanted in a crew member. Everything else was more of a bonus in their eyes. It was that fighting spirit, that drive to protect those who they love, that made the crew of 10 work together and help them to survive any situation. From Muth's perspective, men like Beans, Willie, and Tommy had begun to grow on him. When he arrived in Thurlow, he wasn't quite sure how he was going to feel about his new battle-worn crew members, since he wasn't much of a people person in the first place and felt like a very inexperienced rookie. With what he had felt and experienced on their last mission, he had a better understanding of what his crew members had gone through almost a dozen times. He couldn't imagine having to do what he did the day before 30 more times. Before he arrived in England, a 25-mission tour, later changed to 30, didn't seem so bad. In fact, one of the main reasons why he chose the Army Air Corps was because, by his calculations, he'd be able to complete a tour of duty and make it back home before or shortly after his child was born. It wouldn't be like having to serve in the infantry, he thought to himself, being shipped off to war until the war was over or until you were sent back because you couldn't fight anymore. The air war seemed better to him. The hardest thing of all for Muth wasn't the thought about not making it through his tour or the prospect of death at all. What Muth seemed to struggle with the most was making sure that his fear never appeared on his face. From an early age, he saw men who couldn't bridle their emotions as weak. He believed that a man was someone who suppressed their feelings for the sake of their community. If they couldn't do that, then what kind of man were they? And for that matter, what kind of soldier was he? Soldiers were tough, fearless, and had killing the enemy ingrained into their brain. It was those kinds of men who helped win wars, not soft, emotional brats who didn't know what war carried with it. Surely there were no German soldiers sitting in a beer garden tonight, drinking Dunkels, crying about how tough war is to their buddies. This is war. Things aren't supposed to be tame and easy. War is what challenges us to become stronger men, and in order to think that way, one has to be a tough individual, and if not, war sifts out those who are not strong enough. Beans knew from looking at Muth that he was deep in thought about something. His eyes were trailing off, looking into the abyss beyond. Beans broke Muth's moment of self-convicting by taking their drink glasses and going back up to refill them, much to Muth's delight. Back at Bird in Hand, Mason Pointers, Attila, and the rest of Dropping Deuces' enlisted men dropped in to drink with Willie and Tommy. Jack, Parnell, and Tango had since left to go meet up with the rest of their officer pals in town to drink some more. Everyone at the table was having the time of their lives, except for Tommy, who was trying to act like he was having fun, but kept looking down at his watch and now saw that it was 8:55 and still no sign of the girls were to be found. Willie, who noticed Tommy's change in tone, looked over and said, "Don't worry there, Tommy. There's still plenty of time." "Thanks, bud."
"Hey, I told you. They probably won't come down tonight until closer to 2100, so they could be here any minute. You didn't drink too much, did you? I told Willie to stop me from drinking too much,"
Mason Pointers called out.
No. "He just had one drink and he's been shitting your drink of water over here like a fucking house plant,"
Willie fired back.
"Well, that's a good thing because you don't want to be fucked up when she comes walking in,"
Pick yelled back. As the men continued their joke-telling and teasing of Tommy, that's when the pub door flew open, and walking in was the sight that Tommy had been waiting all night to see, but couldn't believe that he was now seeing it.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast.
A total of 6 girls walked in, and the moment they saw Mason, Willie, and Tommy, they rushed over. The men spread out. Terrence Mercier got up and sat with one of the girls that he knew. Andrew, Wilbert, and Hick left to sit with one another at the bar, and Mason gently grabbed the hand of one beautiful young woman and invited her to sit down with him. As she did, Mason introduced the remainder of the girls to Attila, Willie, and Tommy, the only single guys left. One girl, a cute young brunette, looked right at Tommy and asked him if he was in fact the Tommy. Tommy nodded his head, knowing that this was the right girl. She introduced herself as Betty. Her voice rang with a delightful British accent. Her friend, who was standing next to her, was a bit taller and more animated. She introduced herself as Patricia, or Patty. She had a mixture of an Irish and English accent to her, and once Willie and Tommy invited the two girls to join them, they got along very well. Patty loved Willie's Chicago accent, and Betty thought Tommy was absolutely adorable. Betty and Tommy were only 3 weeks apart in age, and both of them recognized each other from the occasional passing by to and from Burdenhand in the past. In fact, Betty was the sister of one of the girls who was present the night that Skimpy had met Mary. However, Tommy made it sure not to comment or give any indication that he was interested in talking about that night. Tommy was quite surprised by how quickly Betty warmed up to Tommy. Within the first 30 minutes, he had her laughing to the point of tears as he told funny stories and poked fun at Mason Pointers, who was showing a little too much public affection with his girl, or Attila, who was scared of his. On the other hand, Willie and Patty both drank rum together, and soon they left to be off on their own, much to the cheering and hooting of their friends. Once outside, the two began kissing each other, and soon they took a stroll down Dear Jesus Alley, where Willie knew the perfect spot for them to sneak away. Back at Bird in Hand, Tommy felt like the world around him had finally turned off for a moment. For now, he didn't feel like he was in the middle of a war zone. He didn't feel like he was far from home. It was just him and the most adorable and beautiful woman he had ever laid his eyes on. As Betty talked, Tommy took in every facet of her face. The way she looked away when telling a story, and then when her eyes would go back to looking at Tommy, they would light up with joy and inspiration. He took in the way that her lips would move to the side whenever she said something that she wasn't quite sure how it was going to come out. He watched her hands fiddle with her blue, land girl style dress that she was wearing. She was far more than what Tommy was expecting. Looking back over at his buddies, Tommy was surprised to see that the only ones left with him and Betty in the pub was Attila, whose date had long since left him because he was too nervous to engage with her and seemed uninterested in talking to her. Other people were Andrew, Wilbert, and Hick. Mason, Terrence, and their dates had left just like Willie and Patty did. "Well, I guess our friends left us here," Tommy replied.
"Yes, I guess it does seem that way," Betty replied.
"Well, should we go see what they're up to?"
"Why? Do you want to leave?"
Betty asked.
No. Well, you know, unless you want to leave, then listen, I'll go wherever you go. I mean, that sounds mushy. I'm not, you know, why speaking so hard sometimes?"
Tommy joked, once again getting a chuckle out of Betty. With the continuous twinkle in her eye, she looked at Tommy and asked him,
"So what do you do on those Yank planes I see fly over my head all the time?"
It was in that question that Tommy felt pulled back into reality. Putting on a fake smile as to not offend her, he replied,
I'm a gunner."
"A gunner? Well, that must be exciting. Firing your guns at the damn Germans, protecting your mates."
"Look, exciting isn't, it's not the word I would use. Listen, it's just, you know, just a job. Nothing spectacular, especially for me. Because in my opinion, I have one of the worst jobs on a B-17.
With a loud gasp, Betty asked,
"You're not talking about those boys who stuffed themselves into those balls on the bottom of those planes, are you?"
Tommy, showing his immaturity, chuckled at Betty's comment, but then said in a serious tone,
"Yeah, well, that is where I am any given mission that I'm selected to fly."
"It must be awful in there."
"Oh no, it's actually quite comfy in there. You know, I really ever want to leave when it's time for me to get out."
"Really?"
"Nope. No, none of that's true at all. It's hell."
After chuckling some more at Tommy's humor, she responded with,
"Well, I've always wanted to ask, how the bloody hell do you get in and out of those things?"
"Well, to be honest, it's a bit hairy. First, you have to manually move the turret into a downward position so that the guns are pointing down towards the ground. And then you have to open the back hatch of the turret up. And then I have to step into it, putting my feet in those holders that are on each side of the window, the center window. And then I crunch up, you know, like I'm trying to get back into my mother's womb. And then someone, usually my buddy Willie, who came with me, he closes the hatch behind me, locks it up, and then I'm free to move around until it's time for me to get out. And let me tell you, when that time comes, I pretty much shoot out of that thing like I'm a jack-in-the-box."
Before Betty could ask any further questions, that's when Willie walked in the pub, called for Tommy.
"Hey, Tommy, it's almost time for Jack and them to swing by us to pick us up. Listen, if we're not out there, we're walking back and we're going to be screwed."
"Got it. I'll be right there. I'm coming," Tommy said, looking down on his watch.
It was now 2200 hours. Tommy couldn't believe that much time had passed since Betty had walked in and sat down with him. Knowing he had to hurry, Tommy asked Betty if she'd walk out with him, and she agreed. The two walked outside the pub, and there they saw Willie and Patty kissing one last time, Willie's face glowing as he did. Tommy looked at Betty, who luckily was the same height as him, and said,
Where do you live? Do you live around here?"
"Oh, I live over in Hatchet End. It's on the western side of Haverhill. I'd love to take you there and have you meet my brother and my parents. They'd be honored to have a Yank visit them.
Family. Wow. Okay.
That sounds great. I'll take you up on that offer.
Well, actually, do you have a piece of paper? I can write down my house, phone, and my address if you want it.
Want it? Shit, Willie!
Wow. I need a piece of paper and pen.
Well, I don't fucking have one. What do I look like to you, a fucking stationary sergeant?
That's okay. I have an idea, Betty said, taking out her lipstick.
What are you gonna do with that?
Tommy asked.
Take off your jacket for a moment.
Tommy didn't hesitate and took his jacket off. Then, as were her instructions, rolled up his sleeve. Then, gently, Betty wrote down her number and street address on Tommy's arm. Just as she finished up, that's when Jack arrived at the front of Bird in Hand. Tommy and Willie kissed their dates one last time before hopping in the Jeep and heading back towards the base, with Tommy refusing to put his jacket back on.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. Please leave an honest review on whatever podcast app you're currently listening on. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Canso 34 Studios, a DIY project that's helping to raise awareness to the brave young men who sacrificed their lives in the skies of Europe in World War II. I hope we can do it justice. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for another episode of Season 2 of Snafu.